Sangye chudam sohi chunam ma Jom chubardu dharmi kya suchi Dagi jen sogi vi sonam gi Drola penje sangye durshu I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddhas, the Dharma, and the assembly of saints. From the virtuous merits that I collect, by the practice of giving and the other perfections, may I attain the state of a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddhas, the Dharma, and the assembly of saints.
From the virtuous merits that I collect, by the practice of giving and the other perfections, may I attain the state of a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings.
May all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all beings never be separated from the bliss which is sorrow. May all dwell in equanimity, free from aversion. The ground is covered with flowers and sprinkled with scented water. In the middle is Mount Meru, surrounded by the four continents and ornamented by the sun and the moon. By visualizing all this and offering it as a Buddha realm, may all sentient beings partake of the Buddha's pure lands. Om Guru Buddha Bodhisattva Saparivara Ratnamandala Buddha Mega Samudra Saparana Samaya. Okay, welcome. So it's time for a pop quiz. We haven't had one for a while. That's the bad news. The good news is it's open book.
Oh. What part of the grade does this count for?
33.4%. Give or take. So this is the same chart we had up last week. It's not new. But I thought we would just go through it. And what I would like to do this time, instead of me explaining it, I'd just like to go point by point, and just whoever feels like just saying a few words about each point, then we can have kind of a review for everybody, okay? So who would like to start out and say a word or two about impure vision?
Impure vision is the kind of vision that we have when we allow our feelings and our self-centeredness to dictate the meaning of everything to us.
Okay.
And it's not true.
It's not true. Right. It's impure.
It's impure.
Yeah. Okay. And by studying it, what do we hope to cultivate?
Renunciation.
Yeah, renunciation. Okay, good. 5 points. Okay. And how about vision of experience? What can we say about that? Nothing? What section of the book are we in?
The last section.
Which vision?
The pure vision.
We're in the vision of experience still. Mm-hmm. We're still learning how to get out of the impure vision and get some experience happening. Okay, so that's the second. So, what can we say about loving kindness in relationship to the vision of experience? Loving kindness.
Well, the vision of experience is where we experiment with what we've been told, and we that will lead us to and so we experiment with what we've heard so that we can verify it, which is what the Buddha suggested doing. Don't believe anything I say, just check it out, see if it works. So that's what the vision of experience is, and as regards loving kindness, it's wishing that others be happy. And so that's quite complicated, in that we have to know what happiness is to start with, at least in some cursive way, some place to begin, so we can wish it for others. and then see the value of doing that, that which is part of the experiment.
Okay, good. Everybody agree?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, how about compassion? How does that fit in?
It fits in with the understanding that all sentient beings have an incredibly close relationship with us, whether we see that as having been our parents or our children or our kind teachers. You name it, they've been it. We owe them.
Okay.
And compassion for oneself also is to help us to do our experiments appropriately and with the top desire in mind of helping experience happiness, which is a very difficult thing to do.
Okay.
It also arises out of the concept of equanimity.
Yes.
So when we see everyone as very much like ourselves, not different from us, which is part of the impure vision, but we begin to see that all of us are very much alike, in fact, alike. Therefore, we begin to exchange self for other, and this is how the experience of exchanging self for other begins to develop compassion.
Okay. You're jumping a little ahead there.
Yeah.
But let's go back to compassion. If loving kindness is wanting people to be happy, what is compassion?
It's wanting them to be free from suffering.
Free from suffering. Right. Okay, so we want them to be happy, we want them to be free from suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And what about the enlightenment thought? How does that fit in here?
We want to help them to develop these happiness and freedom from suffering by dedicating ourselves to that, helping them.
Okay, and how do we dedicate ourselves to helping them? How do we do that?
Through
I can't help anybody. I don't know what to do.
Training in the Bodhisattva trainings.
Yeah.
To arrive where?
To arrive
at Buddhahood. Yeah,
yes,
Buddhahood.
Exactly.
Because Buddha can help somebody, I can't. So
yes,
I got to
exactly.
become Buddha, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. And if you take these three together, what? How have we studied this in the text together? There's a specific format.
It's the accumulation of merit.
Are you talking about like listening and doing the meditations in the text?
You're on the right path. You're on the right track there. You're getting warm. So what are the three? Listening.
Like, hearing.
Sorry?
Sorry, I spaced out from
you. Okay, the three steps, listening. Contemplation
and then the meditation.
And meditation. So of those three, how do these fit in? Where do they fit in those three?
All three.
All three fit in.
Yeah, because you have to listen and you have to contemplate. But really, these are the format for a meditation sequence. It's a sequence of analytical meditation. You go step by step. It's very difficult to just jump to an enlightenment thought without going through this process for most people. If you're just starting from scratch, you need to recognize that all beings have been my mothers, they've been kind,
yes, yes.
I want them to be free from suffering, how can I do that, become enlightened, well I need to have the enlightenment thought. And then we get into breaking the enlightenment thought down. This is all enlightenment thought here. So let's go to the first one here, the wishing enlightenment thought. What is that about?
That's the aspiration to become enlightened.
Yeah, yeah, I really want to do it. It's a determination, yeah, but I haven't done it yet. I'm just going, oh yeah, I got to do this, I want to do this. And then what do?
We start to practice.
Yeah, we enter the actual practice. Now, why are these three under entering? How does that fit together? Equanimity, that should say, probably, and exchanging and conduct.
Because those are part of the highly skillful practice of exchanging self for others.
Okay, so before exchanging, though, I have to do what?
You have to have equanimity.
Yeah, or the equality of self and others.
Yeah.
Is how we say
see
that,
them as
right?
The same.
And then what do? We exchange self and others. But then we have to learn how to do that. We have to do the conduct. So that's where you get into the six perfections, the four means of attracting disciples. Those are the actual conduct in this system.
I have a quick question. When we say equanimity is the idea of the action exchanging, like the action being exchanging, but then the conduct is sort of reinforcing the action of exchanging. Like it seems very... What's going on?
It seems what?
I
didn't hear the last word.
Like, okay, so if equality is the principle, right? Like I have to see you as Nicole so that I can act in a way that is loving, because ultimately that's what love is.
No, it's not that you have to see me as Nicole.
Okay,
you just have to see that we both want to be happy.
Okay, okay.
Right. And not suffer.
Okay, it's still...
I don't have to be seen as you.
Right. But what I'm saying, it's just still an idea. It's a concept. It's not
necessary. Well, it's a meditation.
Right. But the exchanging of it, is that the physical part of that concept? Or is it the conduct? Or is it the both?
No, the exchanging is not physical. We're still in the meditative process.
Right. So how? So can you tell me, be more specific? So what is that then? Like, what do you mean exchanging?
Okay, let's back up. So I want to get enlightened to help beings.
Yes.
And the way to do that is, first of all, to see that we're all in the same boat. We all want to be happy. We're all suffering. We're all in some sorrow. We all are the same in that sense.
Right.
Okay, that's what equality of self and others means. Exchanging, and I admit from this step to this step is a big jump, but exchanging means exchanging my thinking about, instead of looking out for number one, which is what we usually do,
mm-hmm.
whether we admit it or not.
Right.
We start to shift that and say, well, there's all these sentient beings that need assistance and I'm over here. I need to start shifting my focus to benefiting sentient beings because I've just been thinking about myself and look where it's got me. I'm still stuck in samsara. I need to get out of this mess. And the way to get out of this mess is to get rid of self-cherishing and start cherishing others. So I need to do this shift in my attitude, my mind, my approach. Which is still in the, we're still in the meditative session, but I have to go out and live my life. How do I conduct myself in harmony with all this? And we've been given two sets of practices, the six perfections and the four means of attracting. So that's the conduct where I go out in my life and I live. I'm generous, I'm patient, and all the perfections and so on when I'm actually in the day-to-day nuts and bolts of life. So that I can actualize, because remember, I want to actualize it. That's what entering is referring to, is actualizing it. So this is the how to do it part. Does that answer you?
It's okay. I'm sure I'll come around.
If I could just build on what Michael has just said, when you move from thinking that there is an equality or an equanimity between us, you and I are both human beings, for example, as all of us are here. And then, to exchange self for others, you begin to put yourself in the other person's shoes. You start to see things standing in their shoes, not in your own. It's easier to judge others when we stand in our own shoes.
Mm-hmm.
But if you turn it around and say, well, what if I was standing in his shoes and going through what he's going through or she's going through? Then I start to think in terms of their perspective, not just my own.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah, it just seems like those two are very similar. It's a subtle difference,
but it's a step from equanimity to actually standing in someone else's shoes and seeing things from a different point of view than your own.
Thank you.
Okay. So that's relative enlightenment thought. There's another division, which is ultimate enlightenment thought. And in the text, there's a section about what is the nature of ultimate enlightenment thought, what's the method for producing it, and then the actual practice of it. So far, we have introduced the first part of the practice, which is calm abiding, but we haven't finish that. So that's where we are in the actual text, is we're in the middle of, actually it's not even the middle, but we're in the calm abiding section. Page 164 is where we finished the last time. And calm abiding is the prerequisite for the next topic, which is insight wisdom. So calm abiding, does anybody want to venture a word or two about calm abiding?
It's absolutely essential to have your mind tamed to a certain extent so that you can gain insight. Calm abiding itself is a form of wisdom also. It's a manifestation. There's the wisdom of hearing, the wisdom of contemplating, and the wisdom of meditating. Doing each of those, it all funnels into the insight wisdom. It's all, you take these things apart and you see how much they're actually together.
Okay. So when we say calm abiding, what actually do we mean? What are we talking about?
So what I remember is that this was defined as to continuously reconsider the object, the power object, the virtuous object.
Yeah.
And because the mind is constantly changing, the object will disappear by definition. So to use trinpa, memory, and shepa, awareness, so we remember the object, we bring it back to mind, and we use our awareness to do that, to make sure that
we... Yeah, to check that we're doing that. Yeah, good, okay. And the text went into some nuts and bolts about actually meditating, talked about how to do it by talking about the faults, which is an interesting pattern I've noticed in Dharma teachings, that very often the teachings talk about what not to do first, which is interesting. It kind of twists your brain a little bit. So what are the five faults of the meditator?
Laziness
is the first one, and the one of the main ones. What else?
Forgetting
the instructions, like how to do it, right? I'm too lazy to do it, and then when I get there, I can't remember how to do it. Okay.
And letting your mind wander.
Applying the antidotes.
That's the fourth one, right? What's the third one?
Sluggishness.
The third fault?
Yeah.
Sinking and scattering.
Sinking and scattering, they're together. They're like two sides of the same coin. Mm-hmm. That's half of it. The other one is going to sleep. Okay, getting too agitated, monkey mind, or just snoozing, and various degrees in between all of those. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's the third one. What's the fourth one?
Inactivity.
What does that mean?
Not doing the practice, I guess, or not concentrating on the practice.
You're getting warm. Not doing the... What?
Antidote.
The antidotes.
Right.
Not doing the antidotes is the fourth one.
And then there's the over-applying of the antidotes.
And that's the fifth one.
That's right.
That's the fifth one.
Because you're attached to results.
Yeah. So when you don't apply the antidotes, you don't get the result. And when you over-apply them, you agitate the mind. Mm-hmm. And you don't want that either. So those are the five faults that are classically listed. And then there's eight antidotes. We won't go into that. So that brings us to where we are down here. We're still in calm abiding on 164. And so now we're going to talk about the nine placements of the mind. Somebody want to read those for us on 164?
Yeah, I can start.
Mm-hmm.
The nine placements of the mind. The actual method of resting the mind in tranquility is said to have nine stages. The nine stages of placement are 1, placement, 2, continual placement, 3, repair and placement, 4, perfect placement, 5, subdued, 6, calmness,
7, perfect calmness. 8, one-pointedness. And 9, placement in equanimity.
Okay, so we're going to go through these, and I'll just give you a heads up that the first one, placement of mind, has a whole bunch of sort of subdivisions in it. So we're going to start with placement of mind. Okay.
Placement of the mind. This requires 4 endowments. A, an unmoving object of meditation. B, an unmoving body. C, unblinking eyes. And D, a clear object of meditation. A, an unmoving object of meditation. It is a very isolated and delightful place. One should arrange a beautiful and pleasing object of meditation, such as an image or painting of the Buddha and the like. As was said in the Samadhi Raja Sutra, a bodhisattva who places his mind upon an object of meditation like a very beautiful image of the Lord of the world, i.e. the Buddha, whose body is similar to the color of gold, is said to be in meditation.
Yeah, Lama Jampa said it should be placed at eye level, your object, whatever that is, your picture, whatever.
Otherwise, one can place any suitable object, such as a blue flower, blue silken cloth, and the like, directly in front of oneself, neither too far nor too near and unmoving.
Okay. And Lama said it should be 1 meter away. And he also said you could use a black pebble if you wanted. Now, it mentions a blue flower. Does anybody know, by chance, why that might be mentioned here?
Well, the aurora flower is blue, for starters.
Okay.
Which is in the right hand of the medicine Buddha.
Mm-hmm.
In the gesture of supreme generosity, he holds an aurora, and when a Buddha is in the world, aurora flowers grow and they're blue. But there's also the Tibetan blue poppy, but blue in itself, as a meditative vision, is highly healing and calming of the mind.
Okay. By the way, Bhushar Gardens has those Tibetan poppies.
Yes, they do.
Another angle is that the blue lotus is a hallucinogen.
It is?
Yes, used by the Egyptians to induce meditative trance.
Oh. Learn something every day.
Another.
Okay, I didn't know that. Okay. What do? They smoke it or what?
I think they turn it into like a
nectar.
A nectar.
Oh. Okay.
Something they drink.
Okay.
A wine. It's a blue lotus infused wine.
Blue lotus wine, wow. Okay. I didn't know that. Okay. Any other blue flower comments? No. Okay. Peanut gallery comments. Okay. There's another aspect to this, which is this text is a commentary on Lamdre. Who's the first preceptor of Lamdre? Virupa. And what does Virupa think about the blue flower? He thinks it's really cool.
Aww.
And this particular blue flower was designed by His Holiness the 42nd Sakyatrizin, Ratnavajramshay, several years ago. And since you were all so good on the pop quiz, if you'll come up here, I have one for each. But I'm not going there. You have to come here. I'm sorry? No. I'm making them work for it, Steve.
Oh,
I'm so sorry. I have to go work for it.
Yeah, I didn't sweat this for nothing, folks. Come on.
Thank you.
This is part of the ritual, right? There's a karmic input that happens when you actually physically give something to somebody. I learned this from a lama who rebuked me for turning down a candy one time.
Oh, really? Thank you.
This is also lapis lazuli blue, which is important.
Oh, this is for Lorna. Okay, Lorna. Okay, so that's oral commentary that's not in the book. This is Virupa's blue flower that's mentioned here. All the other things are true too, but this is particular.
Beautiful. Thank you.
And I trust all of you will use that, put
Indeed.
It to good use.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Okay, so a blue flower, a blue silk cloth, a black pebble, or the like, or a picture. Okay, so that is the object, the unmoving object. So who would like to read to us about the unmoving body?
B. An unmoving body. One should practice this by following the teaching found in the meditation manual.
Yeah, this is the intermediate state of meditation by Kamala Shila. Mm-hmm. There's lots of meditation manuals, but this one by Kamala Shila is a pretty famous one.
There it is stated that one should neither open one's eyes too widely, nor should they be closed, but they should be directed to the tip of one's nose. One should sit erect and in balance, with mindfulness directed inward. One's shoulders should be held level, with the head held neither too high nor too low. One should not be leaning to any side, but the tip of one's nose should be straight in line with the navel. The lips and teeth should be held naturally, and the tongue should be kept near the teeth. The inhalation and exhalation of breath should be natural, without making any sounds, hyperventilation or heavy breathing. At any cost, one's breathing should be gentle, inhaling leisurely and spontaneously, and exhalation should proceed in the same manner. Therefore, one should sit on a soft cushion with a straight and unmoving body, complete with all parts of the meditation posture.
Okay, so there's lots of different descriptions about the body positions and how you should sit and your eyes. And also it depends on what meditation you're doing. But this is a good general outline of how it's taught, and so I think that's why they put it in here.
C. Unblinking eyes. The eyeballs should be only half covered by the upper eyelids. With partially opened eyes and without blinking, one should gaze at the object of meditation. If tears and so on arise, they should not be wiped away by the hand, but allowed to fall freely. If pain arises, one should not direct one's mind to the pain, but should remain in meditation and keep one's mind strongly on the object itself.
Why do you think it says eyes half open?
So you don't fall asleep.
That's one reason. What's the other reason?
You start dreaming. Your eyes are closed.
If you close your eyes, you dream, you sleep, you snore. And what about if they're wide open?
It's too distracted.
You get distracted by that, whatever's going by in your world, you know.
Also, if your eyes are half closed, it's easier not to blink.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. Clear object.
D. A clear object of meditation. The object of one's meditation is not to be judged as good or bad, and the like. But whatever the object of one's meditation, that object should be held clearly and vividly by one's consciousness, devoid of any conceptualization.
Okay, so when they say it shouldn't be judged as good or bad, just to elaborate on that a little bit, it's actually more than that. So, for example, say you had a statue of the Buddha, a gold statue of the Buddha, that was your object, 1 meter eye level that you were focusing on. What you want to avoid is not just judging, but naming the characteristics of, oh, look at that gold, it's so bright and shiny, and gee, the proportions are really perfect, and his ears are kind of long, he has that funny thing on his head, but... So the actual discursive mind identifying the characteristics, or if you're looking at a Tonka, looking at the colors and saying, oh, isn't that blue nice? And that's what you don't want to do. So it's not just judging like I like it or I don't like it, but it's actually getting caught up in the specific details. That's not what you want to be doing.
And also, it seems to me that when going from the desire realm to the form realm to the formless realm, It's really never a clear-cut experience of leaving one realm behind and going to the next. It's oftentimes, my experience is that the experiences from the previous realm creeping in, and one of them is cathexis, which is like projecting feelings on objects, either desiring them or avoiding them. And one of the ways that we start doing that, projecting of feelings onto objects, is to discriminate them good from bad. And then, I mean, we actually build thoughts, one of which, you know, by imagining, by bringing into mind an image from our imagination, and then discursively discriminating and then projecting feelings. We build those thoughts.
Right? Yeah.
So it's a way of calming the mind.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And your point about the dividing line is not fixed. There's kind of some, I forget how you worded it, but it's not a distinct line between the realms. There's actually a short reference that made in the text later on to back you up. What else? Yeah, okay.
Continual placement. It is not possible for a beginner to meditate for a long time in such manner. Therefore, one should place the mind upon the object for short periods of time and repeat such placement continually.
Okay, so just so we're not confused, we've all of that previously was the first, which was placement of the mind. And now we're in the second category, which is continual placement. Now this, I personally think this is a really important point, to not meditate for a long time, because over the years trying to teach people how to meditate, one of the things that I've seen over and over again is that people meditate too long. And I don't know how this happened, but somehow people have gotten this idea that you have to do 20 minutes. And I'm not sure where that came from, but it's incredibly widespread. And it's also not feasible for a beginner. To do 20 minutes in the beginning is, you're not meditating. You're just sitting there and doing whatever you're doing, but it's not 20 minutes of meditation. So various teachers have reduced that suggestion down, you know, maybe 10 minutes, 5 minutes, 2 minutes, 1 minute. I actually teach a course where I teach people to start with 15 seconds and get it right. And then you can build another 15 seconds on that, you have 30. And then you go to a minute. But it takes time, and so there's no point in doing it incorrectly. You know, people say practice makes perfect. That's not true. It's perfect practice that makes perfect. And if you're sitting there doing it wrong, you're just making a bad habit worse. And so I believe this is a really important thing to get, especially as we'll see that calm abiding means that you can do it for a really, really long time. So it's better to do it in short but frequent sessions and do it correctly. And your breaks between the sessions can be really short too. You know, it can just be stop, take a breath, or I personally stand up and sit down, because that change in your posture and your blood pressure and everything is a nice break, and it's really clear that that's the end of the session. But however you do it, please, and if you talk to people that are just learning meditation, don't let them do these long periods of time, because they're really, it's not a good idea.
It's a bad idea.
It's a bad idea, yeah. Okay, that's my speech about that. Okay.
3. Repair and placement. If one's mind is distracted from the object of meditation, one should recognize the distraction and redirect the mind back to the object of meditation.
Okay, that's your antidote.
Mm-hmm. 4. Perfect placement. In order not to let the mind wander, through mindfulness one gathers the mind upon the object of meditation. 5. Subdued. Through the fondness for the good qualities of transic absorption, if sluggishness or unruliness arise, one should subdue the mind by the antidotes.
Oh, excuse me, there's the antidotes. Okay.
6. Calmness. If one's mind becomes unhappy due to the cause of distraction and the like, then make the mind calm by directing it to the object of meditation.
This reminds me of something that Geshe Thashi Namgyo told me one time. He said, if you feel unhappy, don't sit down and meditate. Go fix it. If you're angry, calm down. If you're agitated, go for a walk. But don't associate unhappiness with meditation. You don't want to create that association in your experience. So if you notice that even during the meditation, if you're unhappy for some reason, fix it and then go back.
Number 7, perfect calmness. If the opposing forces of meditation, such as covetousness and the like, arise, then for that also the mind should be made to calm down by relying upon the object of meditation. And 8, one-pointedness. Though one has applied the methods that discard sluggishness and unruliness, if one's mind does not proceed into one-pointedness, then place the mind upon that non-proceeding itself. And 9, placement in equanimity. By the power of habituation, one will be able to enter into a state of transic absorption without the need of effort. From this point up to the point where the bliss of accomplishment is produced is the calming abiding of one-pointedness of the mind of the realm of desire. Having produced that bliss of accomplishment, that one-pointed meditation is the real defining characteristic of calm abiding, which places it within the concentration states of the realm of form.
Okay, so this is what you were saying, or part of what you were saying, Stephen. So there's a couple of points here. By the power of habituation, in other words, it takes a while to get this. You have to practice meditation to get to this point. It takes repetition, short sessions, lots of them. But eventually you get to the point where you don't have to do all this work. Your mind just, you know, it's like training a dog. The dog, you know, gets it at a certain point. He's supposed to do this, you know. And so our mind is under training, so to speak. And eventually it gets easier because of the practice that you do, and you don't have to do all this work. Your mind just places and stays there. And then eventually you extend the placement to the point where you have what they call the bliss of accomplishment. We talked about this a few weeks ago, that calm abiding is not just focusing, but the actual attainment of it is that you get this state of bliss. The accomplishment of calm abiding has the component or the state of bliss, blissfulness with it. And having produced that, it says here, that is the real defining characteristic of calm abiding. In other words, until that point, you're still training in it. Mm-hmm. And when you do reach that level, that places you within the concentration states of the realm of form. Remember we talked about the three realms? Anybody remember what they are?
Desire
realm?
Formless.
Okay, so here we're talking about form. And we haven't gone into this, but those realms, of course, have sub-levels or how would you say it, levels. Mm-hmm. And we're not going to go into that much detail here, but there are states within those forms where you have different levels. So when you reach the highest level of calm abiding, you're at the same level as you would be in the realm, the form realm. I didn't say that very clearly, but was that clear?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So now we're going to see what Maitreya says about it. Maybe somebody else wants to read. Anybody want to read? Nicole, you want to read?
Okay. All right.
You don't want to?
Having directed one's mind towards the object of meditation, the mind should not be distracted from continually remaining there. Having quickly realized that it is distracted, it should be repaired by placing it again upon the object. The wise gather the mind inward to higher and higher states. And having seen the good qualities of meditation, one subdues the mind for transic absorption. Having seen the faults of distractions, one is displeased with them and calms the mind. The arising of covetousness, unhappiness, and the like should likewise be pacified. Then the meditator, enriched with vows, together with applying the mind in one-pointedness, obtains the state of mind resting within itself. Through habituation to that, the mind does not need to be applied. Then, having obtained the great accomplishment of body and mind from that meditation, this is known as activation of mind, i.e., transic absorption.
Okay, so this is basically saying the same thing with a scriptural reference to validate what this text is saying. And then it says, to make these nine stages efficacious, at each stage one needs to dispel the five faults through relying upon the help of the eight antidotes as explained above. Okay, we've already talked about that. Also, from among these, one should recognize that the two main faults to be abandoned are sluggishness and unruliness. What are some other synonyms for those? What's sluggishness?
Sinking.
Or sleepiness?
Sleepiness.
And how about unruliness?
Scattering.
Distraction of the mind.
Distraction. What'd you say?
Scattering.
Monkey mind. Okay. Mm-hmm. So those are the two main faults to be abandoned. These other faults, yes. But those are the ones that once you sit down on the cushion, you mostly have to focus on. And here it repeats again, if sluggishness arises, one should reduce the amount of food prior to meditation and sit at a higher elevation. One's clothes and cushion should be thin, and one should recite refuge, complimentary prayers, and so on in a loud and clear voice. And if you go back to the refuge section in here, you'll have some guidelines for the refuge prayers and so on. Arouse the body and mind into alertness and meditate. Okay. If unruliness arises, prevent it by relying upon the methods opposite to those used to prevent sluggishness. And when sluggishness and unruliness are pacified, relax the mind and meditate. There's also other suggestions that could be made besides these. Different teachers and different meditation manuals have lots of different suggestions. If you're sinking, you can think about the benefits of meditation. Like, why am I doing this? What am I going to get out of it? That kind of wakes you up. And if you're scattering, you can think of the problems that scattering has already got us into. Basically, we're in samsara because we're scattered. So you can think about the downside of it and bring yourself out of it. And then the last sentence, it says, when sluggishness and unruliness are pacified, relax the mind and meditate. Once you get your length of time up a little bit, say beyond 10 minutes, Geshe Thashi Namgyo told us one time, he said, focus, you know, for about the first 10 minutes or so, and then once you have your focus, then relax your mind. If you don't relax and you keep this in kind of intensity, you promote scattering. So you want to kind of get your ducks lined up in the beginning and focus and get your object and your meditation stable. And then just ease up a little bit. You're going to continue to do your checking to see that you're not sinking and scattering. But you don't want to be too intense. That's actually a fault. Okay, five experiences of meditation. Do you want to keep reading?
By meditating in this way, a continuous stream of thoughts will arise, one after another, which cannot be measured by the gross mind. Actually, these thoughts were previously there, but since one never placed the mind in meditation, they were never noticed. Now, having become aware of them, there will arise such ideas as, my thoughts have become more than before, or I have failed to produce meditation. However, this is the first experience of meditation, the experience of recognizing thoughts, which is known as like a steep mountain waterfall.
Okay, so this is important. If you're ever teaching somebody to meditate, it's important you warn them about this in advance. Because if a person has never meditated before and they start to do it, they start to recognize this stream of thoughts, which has always been there, but they might not realize that it's always been there. They might blame the meditation and say, oh, this meditation stuff's not for me. It's making me worse. I'm going to not do this anymore. So if you warn them in advance that that's going to happen, because it will, then they're ready for when it happens. They don't realize that it's a mistake or that it's the fault of the meditation practice. It's just
the first stage.
It's the first stage. And actually, the very first stage is recognizing that your mind is scattering. That is meditation in itself, that recognition. And a lot of people think it's a fault. It's not a fault. That's the meditation. You're finally getting in touch with your mind. Right? Okay.
Through meditating in such a way, one will see one thought falling after another. After a while, one's thoughts will cease. But immediately, one will see the flow of thoughts arising again. In this way, one's thoughts will flow and cease alternately. This is the second experience of meditation, the experience of arresting of thoughts, which is known as like the water in a deep, narrow gorge.
That's like the two-way waterfall in the gorge where I live. Has anybody seen that?
Mm-hmm.
You know the gorge here in Victoria?
Mm-hmm.
It's tidal. It goes according to the tide, and there's a little, it's a small waterfall, but it changes direction according to the tide. That's kind of what they're talking about here.
Again, through meditating with great diligence upon continually placing the mind at one point, the flow of thoughts will reverse, like at the time of sneezing, and thoughts will cease. Through meditating upon this seizing with greater sharpness, one's clarity of consciousness is occasionally interrupted by a sudden stream of thoughts. This third experience is the experience of tired thoughts, which is known as like the pool of three converging streams. Again, through meditating in this continuous manner, most of the flow of thoughts will be allayed, and the mind will remain by resting in the state of one-pointed concentration. In that state, only one or two consecutive thoughts will arise, but then instantly they will die down again. This fourth experience is the experience of waves, which is known as like an ocean with waves. Again, through meditating upon the continuity of that previous meditation itself, all outward and inward projection of thoughts completely disappear. The abiding of the one-pointedness of mind along with mind's clarity has arisen. This fifth experience is the experience of pacification of thoughts, which is known as like an ocean devoid of waves. Even though at this time the mind remains in clear one-pointed concentration, free from the activity of thoughts, if one fails to gain the sparkling clarity of consciousness, then it is the calm abiding of the unclear elements of mind. Therefore, to keep the mind in one-pointedness, one should meditate until the sparkling clarity of consciousness arises, which is like the flame of a lamp, unagitated by air. By meditating in this way, if the clear aspect of the object arises, then without looking at the object of one's meditation, one should place one's mind on the clear aspect of one's own consciousness itself by turning the mind inward. If sluggishness and unruliness arise, dispel them by the above methods. Without any effort and at ease, remain within the state of the sparkling clarity of mind. By meditating in this refined way, if one's meditation is not good in the beginning of the session, but improves towards the end of the session, then one needs diligence. Therefore, one should meditate upon one-pointedness diligently. After applying diligence, if one's mind projects outward, does not like to remain in one-pointed concentration, and one becomes mentally and physically uncomfortable, this arises because of the application of too much diligence. So one should meditate in a relaxed state. One should eat moderately and eat whatever is sustainable for one's health. One should restore one's health by sleeping properly, not reversing day and night for sleep. When one has restored one's health, then meditate diligently.
Okay, so this is a description of some various experiences that can arise. You start calming your mind down or letting it calm down. You start having these gaps between thoughts. And then you start having this, the beginning of the experience of clear one-pointedness, one-pointed concentration. It's not clear at first, and then you keep meditating and it starts becoming clearer. Then you have the experience of the sparkling clarity of consciousness. So you want to continue with that meditation experience, and then you want to do, you're going to be doing watchfulness. So if it is not good in the beginning, but then it improves, you need to have more diligence, more concentration, more, you know, focus. But if you apply diligence and your mind projects outward, it doesn't remain in one point in concentration, and you become mentally and physically uncomfortable, that's because you applied too much diligence. So you want to relax, you want to ease off from that. It says one should meditate in a relaxed state, and then it gives suggestions for eating and sleeping and so on. Do you want to keep going, or do you want to pass it?
I can keep going.
Okay.
To contemplate on the meaning of this, one should reside in an isolated place, seated upon a comfortable cushion in Lord Vairocana's posture, and precede the session by reciting the refuge, the complementary prayer, and the creation of the enlightenment thought. Then one should think, alas, from beginningless samsara until now, my mind has been blown around by the wind of conceptualization and has been doing whatever it desired. It has not been able to abide even the time of the snap of the fingers in one-pointed concentration on a virtuous object. Therefore, I have still not crossed the ocean of worldly existence and have not obtained the power to liberate others. This is not good. So now, having relied upon the instruction of a spiritual friend, I must accomplish the special joy of complete purification of body and mind. Having placed my mind in the absorption of one-pointedness, I must obtain the great enlightenment.
Okay, so this just, again, kind of tells you what to do. You want to find an isolated place where you won't be distracted. Vairocana's posture is basically what you see most of these tankas, the cross-legged and your hands on your lap and so on. And then you want to go for refuge, because every practice begins with refuge, right? Complementary prayers you will find again in the first part of this text under the refuge section. There's prayers there you can look at if you want to renew your memory. And then you do this contemplation that's listed here about from beginningless samsara, go through and get yourself in the right state with your contemplation before you go into the meditation. So you want to do like a transition from your daily life and sort of go through this transition and get yourself in the right frame of mind, and then you go into the meditation by generating what? The enlightenment thought. Because that's our motivation, right? Okay?
To accomplish this, having abandoned hyperventilation, unruly and noisy breathing, count one's inhalation and exhalation of breath 21 times without making a mistake in the count. In this way, bring both the body and the voice into balance. Examine the flow of thoughts in one's mind to see which thoughts are gross. If thoughts of attachment to sense desire objects arise, then they should be pacified through meditation on the impurities of the body and the like. Likewise, for hatred, meditate on loving kindness. For ignorance, think about the 12 links of interdependent origination. For jealousy, meditate on the equality of self and other. For pride, meditate on the exchange of self and other, or on the distinctions of the parts of the body.
Okay. Okay, so this suggestion about breathing meditation, that's a very well-known kind of meditation where you follow your breath and count the inhalation and the exhalation, out and in being one. Here it says 21 times, and a lot of meditation manuals say 21 times. My personal opinion is that that's kind of a lot for a beginner. I don't know that you could do it, really. And so my suggestion would be maybe 10 or even 5. And if you get to the point where you're good at doing 5, then you can maybe up it to 10. And then when you're really good at 10, you can up it to 21 if you want. That's just my opinion. Do what you want. But here, if you do this meditation, then you'll notice at a certain point you have a thought. And so what he's suggesting is to, well, notice what kind of a thought is it. And then apply the antidote to it, whatever it is. By now, everybody, you know, we've been through these antidotes a few times. So you notice your breathing. You notice when a thought comes. You notice what kind of thought it is. And then you apply the antidote to that thought that you actually had.
It says, if thoughts of attachment to sense desire objects arise, then they should be pacified through meditation on the impurities of the body. So when they say impurities of the body, does that mean like, is that referring to only like sexual thoughts? Or like what is that referring to? Like, I don't understand.
No, not only sexual thoughts.
Like, what
there are misapprehensions that we have which keep us in samsara. We misapprehend basically everything, but they can be subdivided and named. And one of the misapprehensions that we generally have is that the body is pure. You know, we wash it and we put perfume on it and we dress it and make it up and look pretty. And we're under the illusion that there's something pure there, but really, it's from a dharmic point of view, it's not pure. It's an impure object. A pure body would be the body of a Buddha. They have pure bodies. We don't. We have all kinds of things that come out of our bodies at various places and times, and they're not pure, obviously. But we tend to kind of ignore those kind of, we deal with it, but we don't really treat it as it is, which is, it's not something to be attached to. That's the point, is
so
attachment.
It's attachment. Okay,
yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. You want to pass it or you want to keep going?
I can keep going.
Okay.
Again, one should examine to see whether the flow of gross afflictions are there or not. If there are such thoughts, then apply the antidote for whichever affliction has arisen. Do not allow one's mind to fall under the power of the afflictions and thoughts of this life. When the outwardly projected and the inwardly stimulated afflictions, and so on, cease, one should remember the above-described instructions on directing one's mind. Then, first forcefully place the mind on the object of meditation without coming under the power of sluggishness and unruliness. If it is forced too strongly, then it will become unruly.
This is, again, this is my opinion, but that word forcefully, we have to be careful with that word. It's not forcing in the sense that making something
fit that doesn't fit.
Yeah. I think there's a better word. I'm not sure what the better word is, but I would say place it strongly or focusedly. But forcing, what we definitely don't want to do is force our mind to stop thinking, because basically you can't. And in fact, it says here, if you force it too much, it'll revolt, it'll react, and it'll go even wilder. So
I think maybe the word strain might be more helpful.
How would you say it?
Don't strain your concentration.
Yeah.
And that comes back to the idea of relaxing.
Yeah. You do want to place it.
Yes.
But you don't want to overdo it.
Don't push it. Don't strain it.
Okay. All right.
So, in the middle, One should relax the mind and not be parted from mindfulness and alertness. If it is too relaxed, it will lead to sluggishness. Finally, keeping the mind in its own naturalness, i.e., the non-duality of clarity and emptiness, gently place the mind, without being rough on it, within the state of the clarity of the object. The first two stages are the application of the antidote for sluggishness and unruliness, while the last is the manner of showing the application of equanimity when sluggishness and unruliness are pacified. Therefore, for whatever transient absorption one may meditate upon, these three essential points are very important. Through meditating in this way, when the functioning of thoughts disappear, then place the mind for a long time on the sparkling clarity of consciousness. When one's meditation upon that sparkling clarity of consciousness becomes steady, one should not look on the meditation object, but strongly look at the clear appearance of the radiance of mind itself. If one experiences this in the manner of singular clarity, then relax the mind upon that experience. Do not reflect on the past. Do not think about the future. Do not keep an account of one's present activities, but completely cut any conceptualizations, regardless of being good or bad, as they arise one after another. Remain in the manner of being inwardly at ease, but outwardly attentive. When arising from the meditation session, part from meditation on good terms with it, and dedicate its virtues for the sake of sentient beings. Then refresh oneself, even in between meditation sessions. Do not break the continuity of isolation. Discard all the causes of distraction and outwardly directed activities of the mind, and quickly enter into another meditation session. In the beginning, make meditation sessions short, but repeat them many times. Having become habituated, prolong the sessions. Eventually, one should practice until one can pass a day and night, and so on, in one continuous meditation session.
Okay, so obviously it takes a while to arrive at that point where you're going to be doing one session that lasts day and night. However, it's possible, and great masters go even longer. But that, in a nutshell, is how you do it. That's your instruction on calm abiding, which is the manner of practice to accomplish ultimate enlightenment thought.
Beautiful.
This is pretty advanced stuff. And obviously, it takes practice. But if you want to get enlightened and help other beings, that's the way to do it. So we're going to stop there tonight because the next section is insight wisdom. So now you have some advanced homework that you can do. Any comments people want to make here before we close?
When you said you have, you show people do 15 minute seconds for meditation and then break, is that on your website?
Or
is
no.
That on the website? No.
No, that's live.
Oh, okay.
COVID kind of put a crimp on that, but.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a course I made because I was in Italy and everybody, not very many Buddhists in Italy, so when people found out I was living in this little town in the mountains, everybody wanted to learn how to meditate because everybody had heard about it and nobody knew how to do it. And so I started trying to teach people, and I soon ran into the problems of teaching meditation to beginners who have really wild minds. And I learned a lot of tricks, and one of them is cut down the time. Now, I have to say that was not my idea. The 15-second meditation, I actually learned it at IBA in Kathmandu, but the original source of that was the Buddha himself. So it's not like, you know, we're making this up, folks, as we go. This is from, you know, the Buddha. But over time, I tried different ways and different formats and different sizes of groups and different lengths of time and all this, and I kind of got to see what worked and what didn't work, and I sort of eventually ended up with a sort of doable package. And then when I came back here, I started, same thing, people say, teach me how to meditate. That's what I would go with, because this, what we're reading here, this is really getting long down the road a little bit here. And so you need to kind of back up for beginners and take them through the process so that they can get a handle on it. Otherwise, they quit. And that's a real disaster. Mm-hmm. So, no, it's something that I did in live groups. I don't know that it could be done online.
You mean like live line? Like, you can have a session online that's live.
Well, let me explain that a little more so it makes sense. What I found is that what worked, and I'm talking about what worked for the people, the students, mm-hmm. is that there needed to be a minimum of 4 people in the group. The classes needed to be short, which I found 1 hour was sort of doable. Mm-hmm. And there needed to be a minimum of 4 sessions. So in other words, 4 weeks. So 1 hour a week for 4 weeks with a minimum of 4 people. And if you miss a class, you're out. Because it's too short to miss 25% and think you're going to get it. Mm-hmm. But the thing about doing it live, I found, was that the class taught the class.
Exactly.
In the sense that I'll give you the instructions. You go home for a week and I requested or I required a minimum of 15 seconds per day. The 15-second meditation once a day was the minimum, because what's the number one excuse that people say for not meditating? Huh? I don't have time, I'm busy, I gotta do this, I gotta do that, I don't have time. You cannot use that excuse if you only have to do 15 seconds. You can do that at the red light in your car. At least in this town.
Why would someone so impatient even want to learn how to meditate? I mean, if they think that 15 seconds is too long, what are they doing in the class in the first place?
No, they don't think 15 seconds is too long. That's why they signed up. You see, I tell them in advance, these are the rules. You got to commit 15 seconds a day. You have to come to every class. There has to be a minimum of 4 people. Because what I found is when people drop out, you get down to 1 or 2 people. You don't have enough group learning. And so what happened is that people would go and they would do their homework and they'd do more than 15 seconds, because you can build them. You can do 15 seconds, take a break, another 15 seconds, you can build it, right? And then they would run into these things that we read about. Oh, my mind was scattered, my mind was sleepy, my mind was this, my mind was that. And then they would talk about it. First of all, they would say, they would see that, oh, I'm not the only one that has that problem. But also they would hear suggestions from other students about, well, what I did to fix it or what I did to deal with it was this. And, oh, that's a good idea. I'll do that next time. My cat was bothering me the whole time. Well, put your cat outside the next time, you know. It sounds silly, but there's this kind of group thing that happens that I found was conducive to the absorption of the practice, because people are busy, they get distracted, they quit, or whatever, and all these things that I learned not to do in Italy, or that were problems, I brought here and tried to find solutions for. So that's what I came up with, and it's called the stick dog meditation, which is actually a teaching that the Buddha gave. He said, do you know this one, Karen, where he said, if you have a stick dog and you have a stick, and you throw the stick, what does the stick dog do?
Go get the stick.
Yeah, how many times?
As many as you throw it.
Infinitely, is it? Until you get worn out and stop throwing, the stick dog will run after the stick. But if you throw a stick at a lion, what does a lion do?
Mm-hmm. Get you.
It turns and faces you and stares at you, and you never throw the stick again to the lion. So that's what our mind is like. Our mind is like a stick dog that's just running after everything, you know, all the things in the world, the pretty distractions that are there in samsara. And we don't have the lion's approach, which is boom, focus. right? So that's why it's called stick dog meditation. And that actually came from the Buddha. And this shortened period came from International Buddhist Academy, where they were of like mind. They obviously know more than I know, but they've gone through this, and they've taught Westerners, too. I don't know if this is true for Easterners. I've never taught Easterners. But, you know, Westerners and people that have Western-type mentality, I mean, do you know anybody who's not busy?
I think it's universal. I've done a lot of work in Asia. I don't think it's any different.
Well, they've gotten kind of Westernized, too.
No,
I think
but
there's a productive side to the culture.
Yeah.
Demand.
Okay.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. Well,
it's true of all of us.
Buddha was Asian, so anyway, we have this stick dog habit pattern, and Buddha is even called the lion. That's one of the descriptions of the Buddha, is the lion, because he's the king of the jungle, and he's there, and he ain't chasing your stick. Yeah. So does that kind of explanation for why I'm not sure if it would work online or not? I mean, theoretically it might, but I've never tried it. You want to organize one?
I guess I could, yeah. If there's four other people.
Well, you got to find them. I know how to do this already.
Okay. I think I could find.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay. Let's do our dedication before we all leave, though. So nam de yi tam cha zik pa ni to pa ni pa na nam pam je te ke ga na chi ba lung tu pe yi sit pe tso le do wa dro wa sho jang chu sam cho rin po che Ma ke panam ke gyurji ke manyam parne paryam gong ne gong tu pel parsho jam pa pa wa ji tar ken pa dang kun tu sang pu de yang de jin de ge da gung ge je su da lo je Ke wa di da tam che wa tu nyo Tu su je pi kya wa tam che ki Nyo wa gang la cho tu nga pa gi Tak shin ge we tsa wa di kun kyang Sang po chu che wa tu nga wa gi Cha sa wa dam cho ching cha pa dam Je su yi rang ku shing so wa yi Ke wa chung ze da gi chi sa pa Tam che zo pe jing cha shu By this merit, may all attain omniscience. May it defeat the enemy wrongdoing. From the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death, from the ocean of samsara, may all beings be free. Bodhicitta is precious. May it arise in all beings in whom it has not arisen. May it never decline where it has arisen, but may it ever grow and flourish. In whatever way, valiant Manjushri and Samantabhadra know how to transfer merit, so do I dedicate all my own virtues, and I may train to be like them. Through this dedication, praised as supreme, by the victorious Buddhas of the past, present, and future, I, together with all sentient beings, dedicate these roots of virtue to attaining Buddhahood. May whatever little virtue I may have gained from prostrating, offering, confessing, rejoicing, requesting, and beseeching be dedicated to the attaining perfect enlightenment. Thank you.
Thank you.